I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, we are back. It is the weekend, the opening weekend for Avengers Endgame, and I don't actually expect anybody to be listening to us.
No, I figure a lot of people are running around like myself with cotton in their ears, trying not to get spoiled. But we are going to talk some Avengers today with our guest, who is Mike Cecchini. Mike is the editor-in-chief of Den of Geek, and he's here to talk a little bit about the site. And also, they have a book out called TV Geek, The Den of Geek Guide for the Netflix Generation. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe, you know, just because that's what's going on right now, maybe you can tell our listeners a little something about the book, the TV Geek, the Den of Geek Guide for the Netflix Generation.
So the thing to remember about TV Geek is that it's actually the second Den of Geek book. The first was Movie Geek, and both of these were conceived in the UK by the founder of Den of Geek, Simon Brew. Den of Geek was founded in the UK about 10 years ago. And it was brought to the U.S. about 6 years ago. Movie Geek was kind of the same format as what you'll find in TV Geek. And that was, you know, Simon and some of the members of the Den of Geek UK staff. And I was lucky enough to contribute a chapter or two to something like that over there. But when the time came for Simon to start putting together TV Geek, you know, then we started having conversations about how we could get some of the U.S. staff involved as well, just because so many of the topics in here are so, you know, so relevant to the U.S. TV market. This is still very much reflective of Simon Brew's vision. He was putting this together at a time that he was kind of getting ready to step away from Den of Geek to focus on some other projects. But I was just really happy to help however I could. And so, you know, along with Louisa Malore, who's the UK TV editor, and Ryan Lambie, who is just a brilliant writer that used to do a ton of stuff for Den of Geek and Den of Geek UK, I was able to enlist some key members of my team. So over here, we have Katie Burt and Alec Bajalid, both sharing our TV editor duties, because it's such a huge job. And so they contributed a bunch of chapters to this. Chris Longo, who is my deputy editor for Den of Geek US, he contributed some chapters to this. So it was really a lot of fun, and it was fun to watch it come together. It's a nice kind of tribute to Simon's original vision, I think, for the site, because the thing that has always set Den of Geek apart, we feel, is our devotion to long-form content, but also, you know, in addition to all the topical stuff we do, which of course is so relevant to TV, you know, I mean, because you have to do reviews and recaps and news and all this other stuff that just takes up so much space on a website on a daily basis or a weekly basis. But what we've always really found our audience with, and that we have tremendous affection for, is that kind of evergreen content, is this idea that we should be celebrating stuff that isn't necessarily of the moment. Or when it is, we're looking for ways to answer questions that you have about a show or about the production process or about the characters or about, you know, the costume details or whatever it is. And sometimes it's questions that maybe you didn't even think to ask, but then when you see somebody ask them, it's, you know, it's there. So TV Geek is a really nice encapsulation of some of our favorite things to do on the website, but that occasionally might get lost in the shuffle of day-to-day TV coverage. Plenty of words in here about Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead and, you know, the current crop of superhero television, but there's also stuff about forgotten TV shows, like forgotten sci-fi TV shows of the 1980s and 1990s, and the era of superhero TV before the current golden age that we live in, where things weren't quite as accurate to the comics or didn't have the production values that we've all become accustomed to, but that I really, really love and still have a lot of fun with. You know, if you're looking for new information that you might not know about some of the biggest shows on TV. That's all in here. If you're looking for kind of production and industrial concerns about things like costume details or production budgets or actor salaries, there's things like this in here. It's just a neat thing to have on your bookshelf. And if you're a Den of Geek reader, if you're a regular Den of Geek reader, you'll recognize the tone, be able to kind of dig into some of the pieces that you enjoy on the site. And if you're not, I think you'll get a really good flavor of what we're about and the kind of, the kind of stuff that we like to celebrate.
Cool. Now maybe you can tell, I bet our listeners would be interested with a site like Den of Geek and you being the editor in chief of Den of Geek. How much of that, if we can peek behind the curtain a little bit, is it a lot of freelance writers? Is there a Den of Geek office that people go to? Like what's sort of the physical space of Den of Geek, or is everybody just kind of off on their own doing their own thing and then you kind of organize it from there?
No, we do have an office in New York City, and there is there's a staff that works there. A lot of us do work remotely a certain amount of the time. It's a nice bonus of having a job like this. The majority of our content is produced by our staff. But I do have a team of talented freelancers that put up with me, who put up with my slow email responses and my incessant notes on their, on the great pieces that they send. So it's a pretty cool setup, but Den of Geek is much bigger than, certainly much bigger than it was when I started here 6 years ago. We have a print edition. We do two print magazines a year, one that we distribute at San Diego Comic-Con and one that we distribute at New York Comic-Con. The books, this is the second book that we've done. We have a video department. So it's quite an operation now. It started off as something a little bit more, a little bit more quaint, a little bit more kind of labor of love. And in the last couple of years, it's become something that none of us really expected. And most importantly, I'm lucky enough to be able to do this for a living.
That's great. And so do you guys have, TMZ like meetings on Monday morning about arguing about Game of Thrones and what kind of coverage you're going to do on Game of Thrones for the week?
No, most of that, believe it or not, is done online, just because with entertainment news, with the kind of entertainment news that we do and just kind of the nature of this business, we have to be able to react almost in real time. So because Game of Thrones airs on Sunday nights, that doesn't really give us the luxury of getting together and watch Game of Thrones together. And one of our key staff members is Katie Burt, and Katie doesn't live in New York City. She lives in Boston. So usually when stuff like that is happening, we're all just kind of, whether it's on Slack or whether it's on Google Hangouts, we're all just kind of communicating that way. And I'll direct traffic however I can, but it's the Game of Thrones experts who tend to know what people are going to be looking for as an episode is unfolding.
Nice. How many articles does Den of Geek typically publish in a day, even? I would imagine it's quite a few articles per day, I would think. What's the general amount that's pushed out?
I want to say 30
per day.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I want to say 30 per day. That includes, and 30 is probably like a strong day. But there's news items that break throughout the day. We publish multiple TV reviews per day. We cover every major movie release. We publish supplemental features, deep dives. And then we have, my editorial calendar is packed with anniversaries for sci-fi and horror movies and TV show premieres and things that we know our audience is passionate about. And that really helps spark discussion with the editorial team. And then we figure out what can we write that maybe hasn't been written before about a topic, or, you know, what is our spin on this, you know, on this hot thing of the day. And so it's a lot of content. And, you know, and aside from our New York team, we also have a London office. Don't forget, Denigeek was founded in the UK. So there's still a strong team over there who I work closely with. Rosie Fletcher is our UK editor, and they have a team of news writers and critics as well. So between the New York office and the London office and our freelancers and everybody else, we cover a lot of ground.
Awesome. Patrick, by comparison, Patrick was an editor at SF Signal, which is no longer around. But Patrick, when you were editing, how many posts was SF Signal putting out, like at its height?
We would do 10 to 12
okay.
per day.
That sounds about right for the size. And SF Signal was, I think, as Mike said, it was more of a labor of love. You know, there was no SF Signal office. It was
no, there was John DiNardo and myself, and then later Kristen and different people, basically up at midnight, you know, finishing up posts that had been sent in and trying to get everything scheduled for the rest of the day.
Yeah, that's I'm sure that's a lot of Mike's life too. Well, that's awesome. Before we get on to our picks of the week, I want to take a minute to thank everybody who backs the podcast on patreon.com. We couldn't do the show without you. We are endlessly appreciative of your support. And if you're listening right now and you're not a backer, consider becoming one. It's patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can back us at $1 a month or whatever. And whatever level you back us out, you can get access to our patrons only Facebook group and lots of cool stuff going on there. So once again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Mike, what is your pick this week?
Well, this is kind of off topic for what you probably thought you were getting from the editor of Denigeek, but I went to see Nick Mason's Saucerful of Secrets in New York City earlier this week, or it was last week, sorry. And it was spectacular. Nick Mason was the drummer from Pink Floyd. And he put together a band that is Guy Pratt, who was Roger Waters' replacement as bass player in Pink Floyd. You know, it's members of Spandau Ballet and Ian Dury's Blockheads. And it was quite a band. And the mission statement for the Saucerful of Secrets was to play Pink Floyd songs that haven't been played live in over 40 years. You know, some of which were never played live by Pink Floyd. So it's a lot of Syd Barrett era stuff. And then that weird post Syd Barrett, but pre Dark Side of the Moon, forgotten era of Pink Floyd, where they were still kind of finding their feet and figuring out what kind of act they were going to be. And so it was a wonderful 2-hour show playing these weird little slices of late 60s psychedelia and early 70s noisy kind of, you know, proto prog rock, I guess. And it was really, really something. And the first of the two shows that I saw, Roger Waters showed up and performed Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun with the band. So that was a real treat for Pink Floyd fans, because it's very rare that any two members of that group gets together in public. But for somebody like me, who, you know, I'm a music fan, I particularly love garage rock and psychedelia, and Pink Floyd is perhaps my favorite band of all time. But for Floyd fans to hear stuff that was never played live, or that was certainly never celebrated by classic rock radio, or was never played, you know, on those recent, well, relatively recent tours by, you know, Gilmour or Waters, or the Pink Floyd tours of 1987 and 1994, it's kind of a special moment. And it was both kind of a tribute to the genius of Syd Barrett, and also a celebration of the kind of band this could have been if things went a little bit differently?
First of all, what venue did they perform at?
It was the Beacon Theater.
Okay. What's the capacity of the Beacon?
That's a good question. I can look that up, and if you guys want to edit that real quick.
Oh no, that's okay. Is it 1,000 seats? Is it bigger than that? Is it smaller than that? Is it in that general vicinity? It's not that important. I was just curious as to what.
It holds about 3,000 people. Okay, just under 3,000 people.
Okay, cool. I was thinking about with Pink Floyd. I recently read a book. The author is Stephen Hayden, and the book is Twilight of the Gods. I don't know if you're familiar with that book, Mike, but I think you would enjoy it. And he writes a very long, in-depth chapter about Pink Floyd in that book and about how, you know, what went down as Roger Waters was leaving the band and how then with David Gilmour, how even though Roger Waters was the primary creative force behind the songwriting, you know, the band just kind of kept on going and was arguably, at least in terms of selling tickets live, were even more successful after he left. Not so much in chart hits, but in selling tickets, because I think towards the end of Roger Waters' tenure in the band, he kind of didn't want to play live as much. And obviously, like with The Wall, it was where he wanted to sort of take the band out of the equation almost and sort of literally perform behind a wall. And they only did, I think, maybe like two big performances of The Wall, if I remember correctly. So they were kind of just not performing. And then they eventually left the band, and then the band went out and performed and sold a lot of tickets, and you know that didn't sit great with Roger Waters after the fact. So I don't know if you're familiar with that period in the band's history or with that book, but I think you might find that quite interesting.
I haven't read that book, but I have the unpopular opinion that as a live band, Pink Floyd probably their best tour as a live band came after Roger Waters left, and that was the 1994 Division Bell tour. I also really like the two albums that they put out without Roger. Now, there's no question that, you know, the golden era of Pink Floyd is that, you know, is that period where Roger was kind of the glue, where he was the one helping to conceptualize things, and his lyrics were really kind of you know, crystallizing this vision for the band. But just from a purely melodic standpoint, David Gilmour and Richard Wright were always the soul of that band. So whatever was lost by Roger's departure, you know, something else was gained in that later era. And it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have the spontaneity of those early 70s Pink Floyd performances, but then again, neither did Pink Floyd have that spontaneity in the late 70s or early 80s at the peak of the Roger Waters era. So I don't take sides in the whole Gilmour versus Waters debate. Anytime a member of Pink Floyd tours, I make it a point to see them. I've seen Roger's solo tours several times. I've seen Gilmour as many times as I can afford, which is not that many because you guys know what I do for a living. but you know, it's one of those great rock and roll stories. It's one of those great kind of tragedies about what happens when creative people can't find a way to work through their differences.
And I'm a kind of the same mind as you are, not specifically with Pink Floyd necessarily, but with a lot of the artists and bands that I enjoy. Generally speaking, yes, I'll have my favorite periods. I think a lot of times fans will have the, oh, it's only their first two albums that are good and I don't really care about anything after that. And there are certainly bands that I feel that way about. But the bands that I really love, I genuinely appreciate all the various eras. And even if that moves into them having quite different lineups by the end, it's kind of, you know... sometimes it's weird because they may have the same, you know, they're operating under the same name. Maybe aesthetically it would be more pleasing if it was different names of bands for different eras. But I often like all the various eras of whatever band that I like, and I'll just be in the mood to listen to, you know, whatever particular lineup or particular band in that time. But I always dig in. I generally appreciate a lot of what a band has to offer, not just whatever maybe is considered their classic or their golden age. So I'm with you on that.
Give me an example. Because I'm curious, because I'm thinking it's like, we talking about Hawkwind, we talking about King Crimson, we talking about the Rolling Stones. I'm just trying to think of.
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, I think King Crimson is a great example because they've had so many different lineups and they sound so different. And I do like 70s era King Crimson, but my favorite is the 80s lineup with Tony Levin on bass and Bruford on drums and Adrian Belew playing guitar and singing. That's my favorite, those three albums they put out in the 80s. But I like the 70s stuff. And then I liked the 90s stuff when they did the double trio. But even something more popular, like, or populist, look more like even like Van Halen. Like, I like David Lee Roth era Van Halen, and I like Sammy Hagar era Van Halen. I look at them as kind of different bands, but I am just as likely to listen to the David Lee Roth era stuff as I am to the Sammy Hagar stuff. And then, you know, obviously then I'm a big Rush fan. So, I mean, Rush's lineup was consistent other than the first two albums being with a different drummer, or the first album being with a different drummer. But they obviously have periods that are very different. And I love the keyboard dominated 80s stuff where they were more like almost new wave or the Police or something, and heavy on the synths, as I do their kind of rock opera stuff in the 70s. So yeah, there's lots of different examples to point to, but those are the first couple that hit me. But cool. Patrick, what's your pick?
Boy, I don't know after all that.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to get into
it. You guys went pretty deep. Yes. You know, deep dive into music there. The music nerds are going to love that.
Yeah. Do you got anything, Patrick, or do you want me to do my pick first?
Well, I'm going with Avengers Endgame.
Oh, well, of course, and that's going to lead to a main topic. But yes, spoiler free, give us your thoughts.
I was super excited to see the introduction of the Great Lakes Avengers and to know that they were the key to defeating Thanos. You know, just having Skrull Girl and the rest of the team there, I thought was awesome.
I said no spoilers. Cool, but liked it, I'm assuming.
Yes, I liked it a lot. It was interesting to me that there was a guide to when to go to the bathroom that had been released earlier in the week, which I thought was kind of funny because it's a long movie, you know. I don't think anybody left.
Yeah, don't drink anything before you go in.
Yeah, it's just basically, you know, hit the restroom and then go into the movie so you don't have to leave again. It reminded me as an experience of Return of the Jedi.
Interesting.
And let me clarify that. So, when I went to see Return of the Jedi as a kid, I remember there were cheers, there was clapping, there was a lot of audience interaction with the screen, and that was what was happening with Avengers Endgame. There was cheers, there was clapping, and I was like shocked because you don't really see that much anymore.
No, the only thing, you might have some clapping at the end of a movie sometimes, but even right. That's kind of rare. But yeah.
Yeah, there was people going, you know, yeah, and cheering and all kinds of stuff throughout the entire movie. And so that was very interesting. And of course, when you get that kind of energy going in a movie theater, it's infectious and everybody kind of jumps on board. So that was really cool. I think that there was probably only one surprising thing in there for me. Mm. I had expectations of what was going to happen. And once things settle down and more people have seen it, there are definitely things that I want to talk about.
Definitely. Well, I will. You know, I'm doing that thing where I go through phases with actually going to the theater, and I'm in a phase where I haven't been going and I haven't seen Captain Marvel yet. So I did this with the the last Avengers movie where I saw Black Panther the week the Avengers movie came out, mm-hmm. and then saw Avengers like a couple weeks later. So that's probably what I end up doing, is maybe trying to go see Captain Marvel this weekend or soon, because it's still out. You could still catch it in most theaters around here, at least anyway. And then maybe go see Avengers next week or in a couple weeks or whatever. But that's, I'm sort of in that boat right now too. So, but cool. You know, my pick will be something that is something else that we had sort of planned to talk about. And it's not Game of Thrones specifically, but as I often mention, I sign up for HBO when Game of Thrones comes around, and I usually wait until the first couple of episodes air, and then just watch the first couple that are out, and then have my subscription for a month and catch the rest of it. And that's what I did this time. But the thing that I did differently this time is that instead of signing up for HBO specifically, or just going through it through the HBO app, I did it as an add-on through Hulu, which Hulu allows you to do that. And I know Amazon allows you to do that. And there's a couple different services that where you can do it as an add-on rather than...
Right. And they allow that now, but just wait until you have to pay for every single service separately, and then you won't be able to do that anymore.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is. I mean, because you can really... Your Hulu bill can be crazy with everything that you can add on to it if you so chose on a month-to-month
right. I'm just
basis.
Saying once they get rid of all the aggregators like Hulu...
Yeah,
you won't have that option anymore.
It's interesting. Yeah, I would. You may certainly be right about that. But I am going to sort of have that as my pick, because I did that over the summer with Showtime, because Showtime had a couple things, and I think I didn't even pay for it. I think it was just like a 2-week free trial, and I just got it for the free trial for 2 weeks and watched four or five movies.
So what's your pick?
My pick is using the add-ons through Hulu to sign up for HBO through Hulu rather than right through it, because it does integrate quite nicely. It just sort of becomes another thing within Hulu. So you're using the Hulu interface rather than the HBO Now interface. And because I'm comfortable with the Hulu interface and for the most part like it, it's kind of nice to have all that HBO content through Hulu. So I'm picking that. Gotcha. And plus I got an extra, because it was the first time I've done it through Hulu, they give you like an extra, they give you the first week for free, and then you do it. So it's like,
I'm sure as soon as Disney is finished gutting Fox, they'll turn their attentions to Hulu and stop that shit immediately.
Or they'll just use Hulu as the Fox channel and throw all the Fox stuff there. I've heard stories of that. So who knows what Hulu's going to look like in another year. If it's even there, but that's a conversation for a different time. But that's my pick, and I have been watching Game of Thrones that way through Hulu.
You've seen Mad Max, right?
The most recent one?
Yeah, any of them, any of the Mad Max movies. You know that desolate wasteland?
Yeah,
that's going to be Hulu in a year.
Could be. So Mike, now Patrick and I both brought up Avengers and Game of Thrones. So do you want to get into some spoiler-free thoughts about either of those? Do you want to start with Avengers? I know you were pretty hyped about that.
Yeah, let's start with Avengers. Just because... So I've seen it twice. I saw it at a press screening earlier in the week, which was fun. And it was a pretty engaged crowd. But then I saw it with the Thursday night crowd. And that was just like what Patrick was talking about. It was honestly one of the most fun movie going experiences I've had.
Yes.
And a lot of that was because of this crowd. So obviously at that point I kind of knew what was coming and when it was coming, and I could kind of anticipate, you know, how people were going to react, but it was still so much fun to see it happen. And it added a whole different dimension to the experience. And there were moments where, you know, the theater that I was in actually shook from people applauding and stomping their feet. And I can't remember that ever happening. You know, I remember.
Yeah, see, for me, that's Return of the Jedi. That's the last time I remember that.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, this kind of felt like, you know, the kind of old school communal movie going experience that people are constantly decrying the death of in the, you know, in the streaming era and the peak TV era and everything else. And I guess there really is something to that. And, you know, look, I I see all these movies, and I also like to see them opening weekend because I love experiencing them with a crowd. But this was electric, and it reminded me a little bit. It did put me in the mind of 2012 when the first Avengers movie came out. And that was before I was in the business, so obviously there were no advanced screenings for me. And I went to, you know, a midnight screening on Thursday night with a buddy of mine. And that was when this was still a novelty, where the idea that, you know, that there had already just been a consistent string of good superhero movies was even a novelty. And now here we were, right? I mean, it was a total, feels like ancient history now. And and now it's like, okay, you know, wow, we've had this great run of movies with, you know, the Christopher Nolan films and you know, the early days of Marvel Studios. And now let's see how this is going to, let's see if they could pull off this little team up movie. What a fun little novelty this is going to be. And I sat there in disbelief as that movie connected with everybody in that room. And then I saw it a few more times and I realized that one of the key drivers of that first Avengers movie success, I think, was that feeling of people would see it, realize it was good, and then they would tell their friends, we have to see this together. You know, like I saw Avengers four times in the theaters. I don't do that anymore. I don't do that for anything. You know, I live and breathe this stuff. I don't see anything more than twice most of the time. I saw that movie four times, not because I had to see it four times, but it was like, oh man, I gotta take my, you know, my best buddy from high school who was, you know, my partner in, you know, in comic book nerdery when we were kids. You know, I have to see this with him. That was, I think that drove a good chunk of that early success. So now it, you know, what we're seeing with Endgame is something completely different. I mean, this is, you know, our entire culture is laser focused on this one movie right now. But I think, you know, you kind of have to go back to that moment in 2012 where people wanted to see these movies together because they're fun. They wanted to, you know, they wanted to laugh at the jokes together. They wanted to feel that little shudder when the team comes together for the first time. And Endgame is all of that stuff just on the biggest scale imaginable.
Yes.
I'm glad that you brought up the first Avengers movie because I was having a discussion similar to this with my brother-in-law, and we were talking about the early Marvel movies. And
define early.
Of the current run.
I was going to say, because you got to remember, I was at a comic book convention in the early 90s, and a guy had on his table The Punisher for sale. Right. And I was like, I didn't even know they made a Punisher movie. I'm going to buy this. And it was Dolph Lundgren and Lou Gossett Jr. And it was the worst thing you've ever seen in your life.
Right. No, I'm talking the starting with Iron Man in 2008.
Okay.
But I think what we kind of forget, because it's built into what it is now. It was on a little bit of shaky ground, I think, for the first couple of movies. Obviously, the first Iron Man movie was very successful, but the next two, I believe, are the Hulk movie with Edward Norton, which is canon as part of all this, even though he was recast. And then Iron Man 2, Mike, you maybe know this better than I do, but that, I think, is the third movie in this, and they really sort of made an effort to try to make it a bigger world, even though Iron Man 2 is sort of, when people rank all of the movies, all the Marvel movies, that's generally at the bottom or near the bottom, at least anyway. But it's sort of funny to think back that Iron Man 2 kind of comes out before you have a Captain America movie or a Thor movie. And the fact that they kind of then Thor and Captain America came out, and then so what number is the first Avengers movie? Is it like the sixth movie? Mike, do you know that offhand?
Hang on. I want to say it is the fifth, but hold on. So it's Iron Man 2, Incredible Hulk, Thor, Captain America, the first Avenger. It is six. Yeah. Avengers is Marvel 6.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds about right. So really, it's still early days. You know, you don't have Guardians yet. You don't have Doctor Strange. You don't have Ant-Man. They kind of introduced the big four and then put them all in a movie together pretty quick. So yeah, that Iron Man 2 one is it's kind of an anomaly, even though that introduces Black Widow, that introduces War Machine. You get little shout outs to the Captain America shield and the, I think Iron Man 2 is where they find the Thor hammer, right? Is that sort of the post-credit scene? I think it's like Coulson out in the desert with the Thor hammer. I believe that's Iron Man 2, if I'm correct. So it's, yeah, that was like a big leap, that first Avengers movie. And I think just sort of set it up to where it is now, which is as Mike said, like, you know, this amazing thing that the whole kind of nerd world is, well, not even, I shouldn't even say that, because people who wouldn't have identified as nerds a few years ago, like, everybody's into the Marvel. I mean, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people are, you know.
Well, there's people, it's just like Game of Thrones. There are people who are into this stuff who never were into the comics and wouldn't necessarily consider themselves a superhero fan. There are people who watch Game of Thrones who have never read the books and don't consider themselves a fantasy fan, mm-hmm. right? But they watch that show religiously.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with these movies. And one of the things that Marvel did really well from the start with Iron Man is they figured out people love the cameos. People, like, when you picked up a Spider-Man comic book and in the corner it said, you know, special appearance by Wolverine or special appearance by Daredevil, that got you excited. Oh, what's that character going to do? Why are they here? Are they going to fight? What's going to happen? And they kind of cashed in on that with these movies. When you're watching Iron Man and suddenly Nick Fury's there, and you're going, whoa, Nick Fury's in this. And then you're watching the next movie and you know, there's Coulson and there's a mention of X, Y, and Z character. And, oh, look, here comes Black Widow. Those kinds of crossover events are for some reason, in fandom, get us excited. And we like that. And then they culminate that with Avengers.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, to kind of make a comparison to where Game of Thrones is now, it's interesting. One of the reasons why I wanted to start watching it now is because I knew we were going to have Mike on the show, and I wanted to catch myself up because I maybe would have waited a little longer. But what's funny is at the time we're recording this, it's only two episodes into the season. When this episode goes live, there'll be a third episode, and who knows what's going to happen in that third episode. But honestly, there's not even really a whole lot to spoil from the first two episodes, other than, I think, and it's probably just because we were talking about it, but you can make sort of a comparison to the Avengers in that, within Game of Thrones, it was all of these separate characters all over the map of Westeros, you know, of that world, doing their own separate things. And this season, although last season to a certain extent too, now it's like everything is all converging now. So I think it's almost like this season of Game of Thrones is like the Avengers movie of this universe. Mike, what are your thoughts about that with Game of Thrones?
It's funny that you use the Avengers metaphor for this season of Game of Thrones, which you're absolutely right. I just hadn't thought of it that way. But the reason it's funny is because when I watched the season premiere, the thing it reminded me most of was kind of like the opening of Return of the Jedi or the opening of any, like, anything other than an opening chapter of a Star Wars saga, where you have that first 15, 20 minutes of kind of getting the band back together. And it's like, and look who's here, and look who's here. And that episode also had kind of a strangely hopeful tone, which is something that you don't usually associate with Game of Thrones. Yeah, there's definitely this kind of blockbuster feeling coming with this season. And that first episode was, yeah, it was very important to get all the pieces in place and make sure that everybody was at Winterfell and so that everything could happen. That second episode, though, which was nothing but character moments and talking, was spectacular and really, really moving. And so I am completely convinced that nothing good is going to happen for anybody in episode 3.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I'm guessing a high body count. Yeah. Episode 3. Yeah. What? And what?
Maybe they'll have a wedding.
Oh, forget it. Then they'll all be dead. It's interesting because it on one hand it does feel weird seeing all these characters interact who are so separate and like literally worlds apart for the entire run, but I didn't rewatch all of this leading up to it. But as you mentioned, Mike, all these different character moments, you're like, oh yeah, that's how these characters would be connected because of this, this, and this, and oh yeah, and it felt, you know, this is a term that people use a lot, I think, when they're talking about storytelling and particularly in genre, you know, all of those interactions, all of those moments, to me felt earned, meaning like we built these characters, we had them go through all this stuff, this, this, and this, now they're going to have this interaction, which, you know, remember this from season 2? Well, here you go. This is what these, because it's like, oh, of course, this is what these characters would be talking about because they have this shared thing, or they had this, this person killed this person in their family, or this, you know, it's, so it all felt like I forgot about so much of this stuff. And it's like, oh, it just shows how much they've done over the course of 7 and now 8 seasons.
Yeah. You know, it's, you kind of believe the hype with Game of Thrones, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, it's rare. I'm one of those people, and it's weird for me to say this considering the line of work that I'm in, but there's still something, I don't know if it's something from like my teenage years or what, but there's still that little part of me that when everybody is saying that this is the thing, there's still a little part of me that goes, yeah, well, we'll see about that. And like, it took me a little while to come around to Breaking Bad for that very reason. And of course, Breaking Bad is a masterpiece. And I was late to the party with Game of Thrones, not because I didn't think I was going to like it, because of course, this is clearly, you know, I spent my high school years playing Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering. Like, of course, this hits me right in the heart. But I was still late to the party, and I was like, all right, well, let's see, how good can it possibly be? What could HBO possibly know about this kind of high fantasy and whatever else? Well, here we are. Like, here we are. It's another instance of, you know, of everybody coming around to what people like us have known our entire lives, right? Which is that these are kinds of the best venues to tell these stories, like the human stories written on the grandest scale imaginable have the most impact this way. So, yeah, I'm all in, and it took me a little while. And you know, I think it was season 3 had already wrapped before I actually started watching. And then I just burned right through it.
Did you read the books prior, or have you just watched the series?
No, I only recently read the first book, and it's quite mm-hmm. good. I'll eventually read the whole series, but after reading the first book, I said, you know what, I'm going to wait until the show wraps, because I think it was right after I read the first book, HBO announced that they were going to bring it to a close with this season. So I said, okay, you know what, I'm going to hold off. I'm going to wait until the show is complete. This way, these two things are not, you know, these two visions are not going to be competing in my mind, because, you know, at Den of Geek, we have David Crow, who is, he's our movies editor. He's our head film critic, but he's also our Game of Thrones guy. And he writes these beautiful, epic, like 3,000 and 4,000 word reviews of Game of Thrones episodes. Plus he leads the charge on all our supplementary content. So he kind of keeps me honest with this stuff. So I know that the books and the show have diverged in various ways, both for creative and practical reasons. So now I'm like, okay, I do love this world and I do want to invest in this world, but I'm going to wait until the show is done, and then I'll burn through the rest of these books. Now, did I read tons of fantasy? Of course. Like, you know, and it was all, you know, it was all like kind of paperback fantasy, like, you know, like the Dragonlance books and the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant and, you know, and Michael Moorcock's Elric series. Like, that was all the stuff that I kind of, you know, and the Shannara books and that was the stuff that I was reading when I was, you know, smoking pot and playing Dungeons and Dragons and whatever else. So, you know, clearly I'm going to love the rest of these books. It's just like they kind of grew up with me.
Now, are you going to wait till the series is over? Or are you going to wait until George R. R. Martin actually finishes writing all the books?
No, because I want to actually read these books. So.
Yeah, it is interesting because when he comes, and obviously we don't need to rehash all that stuff because that's obviously a favorite topic for people to talk about it in terms of him not keeping up with the books, but it's such an unusual thing that the series got ahead of the books, and he has so many other things.
Is it really?
Well, I mean, can you think of another example where a TV series or a movie series outpaced the books? Dexter. I can't think of it. Okay.
I believe Dexter did.
Okay. I'm just saying because the books got more and more as it, you know, the first three books and like the TV series hews pretty closely to the first three books. But then by the time you get to book 4 and 5, and where the TV series is at, they're in pretty different places by the time you get there. And George has got a lot to wrap up that they just sort of either ignored in the series or wrapped up early on. Like there are characters floating around in the books right now that either were never in the series or that they killed off or what have you, that George is going to have to do something with. And now maybe you would know this, Mike, better than I do, but I guess Winds of Winter is the next book. Is that the last book or is that what's the status right now? Do you even know?
I don't know.
I honestly
don't know.
I can't imagine him wrapping it up in one more book. I would think it's going to be more than that, but that's the age old question with these long series is, you know, when is it going to wrap up? Oh, it's not going to be one book. It's going to be three books. Now we're going to split it. Cause you know, when you have so many characters in so many different areas, it is often difficult to wrap it up in one book. Just ask Brandon Sanderson, who finished the Robert Jordan books. It took him 3 to do that. Patrick, am I correct there? I think so.
Yeah. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, where it was supposed to be 1 and it took him 3. And I think he was being as succinct as he probably could possibly be through that. But just to kind of tie up all the loose ends.
Well, and look at nothing in this age of, you know, of intellectual property and franchising and everything else. Nothing ever ends now. You know, there have been more Dune books written by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson than Frank Herbert ever wrote, by a considerable margin. So even if George never decides to actually wrap up this saga to everybody's satisfaction, I guarantee you somebody's gonna. It might take, you know, it might take 10 years after he's gone or something, but like some publisher somewhere is gonna say, there's too much money in that Song of Ice and Fire brand. We gotta get somebody in here, you know, and they'll call somebody up. And, you know, that's whether you think that's a good thing or not is entirely up to you. But look, Martin has been prolific throughout his career in other ways. I mean, you know, he edits tons of anthologies and everything else. So, at this point, the guy has made his mark and he's earned the right to take as much time as he wants with this series.
I agree. Now, okay. So once again, Mike has a book out, or Den of Geek has a book out that Mike is a contributor to. It's called TV Geek, The Den of Geek Guide for the Netflix Generation. You can get that. That's available as paperback. It's available as a Kindle book. Audiobook on this one too, or just print?
As far as I know, there are no plans for an audiobook, but if that changes, hopefully they get somebody a little bit more eloquent than me to do it.
So that is out there. That book sounds right up our listeners' alley. So go and check that out, everybody. Mike, once again, is the editor-in-chief at Den of Geek. Anything else you want to let our listeners know that you have going on or that Den of Geek has going on that would be of interest to them, Mike?
Well, we're getting ready to get to work on our San Diego Comic-Con magazine. We only do two of these print editions a year for now. But, it's always a big deal for us. We fill it with exclusive content and first look stuff that that's a little harder to get on a day-to-day basis for the website. It's kind of crazy to say, in April that San Diego Comic-Con is looming, but it is, it does take us months and months to prepare for it. And we send a big team out to San Diego. So, this week kind of starts the clock on our real planning for that. And we made a real big splash there last year, and hopefully we're going to do it again this year. And I think we're going to be able to bring everybody everything that they need as far as staying on top of all the biggest pop culture news.
Awesome. Cool. Once again, if you dig the show, consider becoming one of our backers, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Back as a dollar a month, you could be in that private Patreon-only Facebook group, and lots of cool stuff going over there. So once again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything you want to leave our listeners with before we go?
I just want to remind folks that I am on a 4-episode run of the Beyond the Trope podcast in May. So head over to beyondthetrope.com and check out those episodes as they drop throughout the month.
Awesome. Mike, thanks so much. Great talking to you. Hopefully we can have you back on again at some point and talk nerdy stuff. We appreciate your time, and best of luck with the book and the website.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. All right, everybody, have a great week, and we will see you next time.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
'You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.